Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Start Your Week, your need to know on news and politics. I'm Ros Taylor and joining me is Alex Andreou. Hello, Alex.
Good morning, Ros. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's nice and sunny this morning. Now, Rishi Sunak lost another Tory MP over the weekend, Mark Mingus, who allegedly used thousands of pounds of party funds to pay off some bad people who'd locked him in a room. He's resigned due to the pressure on him and his elderly mother. Yet another one who's leaving his party due to scandal, but not leaving the Commons. Is that acceptable?
I mean, obviously not. We need an overhaul of the laws concerning recalls, I think. The people of filed deserve better than being stuck with someone representing them who, for whatever length of time, be it 2 or 8 months, will have no standing in Parliament, really. He can't properly represent his constituency. How can he stand up and raise an issue on behalf of a constituent? How can he ask a PMQ? He's reduced to a punchline. The fact that he's announcing he has left the Conservative Party and will be standing down at the next election. I mean, why is he continuing to draw his salary for the next however many months? I just don't understand it. And I think there plainly needs to be a change in the rules. It's also quite striking how all of last week Conservative ministers kept praying in aid of principles like innocent until proven guilty and inappropriate to comment while an investigation is ongoing, or not fair for me to try and tell the police how to do their job. All things that applied to the manufactured outrage around Angela Rayner. They were very, very happy to comment on an ongoing investigation then, but have gone very, very quiet last week. Life comes at you fast.
Well, you never know. He may know something we don't about when Rishi Sunak is going to call the general election. The PM's got a press conference today. He's presumably ramming home the message that the Lords have got to cave in over the Rwanda bill. It's back in the Commons today after a lot of ping pong with the upper house. And this time, the government insists it's going to go through. Have the peers managed to make any important changes?
They haven't, and I think the lack of any kind of compromise is part of the reason why the Lords have dug their heels in. The government has made absolutely no moves to meet them even 2% of the way. They've just flatly turned everything down. I mean, usually a government will offer a sort of soft sop, like a ministerial statement to say, well, look, we don't expect that's the way the law will operate and we don't plan to do X, Y, and Z. They have offered nothing in this case, not even the soft assurances that really aren't worth the paper they're printed on. And so I was listening to a crossbench peer speak on the Today programme just before we recorded this, and they really do not sound in compromising mood. So this was Lord Carlisle, a former legal expert, who said that this bill is the most inexplicable and insensitive he's experienced, that what Rishi Sunak is trying to do is to force Parliament to say that something which is not true is true, and that Sunak does not seem to understand the purpose of the House of Lords, which is to amend legislation in order to make it of sufficient quality. And he was very keen to point that this is not a manifesto pledge in any way. This is not something that has been voted for by the people, which Lords would be hesitant to sort of make stuck. But this is something that Sunak has just decided to do, and he described it as ill-judged, badly drafted, inappropriate, and illegal in current international law. I think it's going to be a long night. And the fact that Sunak has indicated that he will make both houses vote until his bill goes through, it seems to me that he's playing his very last trump card, which is the relative youth and vigor of the House of Commons versus the House of Lords, which tends to be sort of much older in average age and may struggle as we go into the wee hours of the morning. But no, it shouldn't be like this. Really, the legislative process should be one of consultation and consensus. It shouldn't be trying to ram things that have no popular mandate through a house that dislikes them.
And the something that is not true that Lord Carlisle referred to is, of course, the claim that Rwanda is a safe place to deport people to. The question of Afghan refugees and what should be done with them if they worked for the British Armed Forces is also quite live today, isn't it?
Yes, those are the two. So the two amendments that the Lords have insisted on are one, that there is some kind of way of saying independently that, yes, Rwanda is a safe country, in fact, that it has complied with the treaty that it proposes to sign with the UK, and that this isn't a perpetual situation, right? Because the way the legislation is framed at the moment, it makes Rwanda safe forever until another primary piece of legislation is passed to say it is not. So war could erupt in Rwanda in a week's time, and the law would still consider it safe, which seems to me a completely sort of untenable position. The second point that they've really dug their heels in over is this idea that there should be an exemption for people in Afghanistan who worked with our armed forces and may be in mortal danger if they stay in Afghanistan, because we know that the scheme for getting people out of Afghanistan is really a joke. You have to basically make it out of Afghanistan to go and apply for the scheme and then come back to Afghanistan to wait for a decision. It's a nonsense.
Meanwhile, there's just 10 days to go until the local elections. Alex, what's the feeling around those at the moment?
There were several rounds of national voting intention polling last week, and every single one of them indicated that they're moving the wrong way as far as the Tories are concerned. So the gap is either staying exactly the same or opening. And it is both Labour who are benefiting from the further drop and Reform. So it's a bit of a nightmare scenario for the Conservatives. And I think it's a very dangerous moment for Rishi Sunak, more than people, I think, imagine, because there is a mathematical result. There is a potential catastrophe there, a sort of swing so big that he has to resign afterwards, right? There is some sort of result which makes his position untenable, either because people will turn around and depose him, or because he will find it irresistible to say, look, this isn't working out for me. And I think the mayors are especially important in this, because there are a couple of quite popular personally mayors around the country whose rating and whose polling is really suffering because of the national polling of the Tories. So Sunak is dragging people like Andy Street down with him. And I think a lot of MPs who think they are personally popular in their constituencies will be looking at results like that and thinking, he's going to drag me into unemployment with him, and actually possibly with a different PM who didn't so much affect my personal rating, I might be able to get away with the next election. So I really do think it's a dangerous moment for the government.
Yes, I think if they lose Ben Houchen in the northeast, that would be a bit of a bellwether moment. But I have to say, I don't think that Sunak would resign triggering a leadership contest. I think he'd resign and call a general election. But that's just my hunch.
Maybe.
Anyway, he's off to Poland this week to meet Donald Tusk, the newish PM there, and they're going to talk about Ukraine. Tell us about the big development over the weekend in the US.
So the House of Representatives has finally approved the $61 billion, which is about 50 billion quid, the package of aid in the Ukraine. It was the House of Representatives that was seen as the main obstacle in Congress. So the Senate is largely expected to pass the legislation later in the week. I think on Tuesday it goes to them, after which President Biden will sign it into law. It is a huge, huge boost. I mean, it cannot be overestimated how vital the support was, especially seeing as it includes ammunition, which is already rationed among Ukrainian troops, and air defense systems, mid to long range missiles and artillery shells, which we know Ukraine was running very, very low on. So a huge moment, I think.
The sense that Russia is a direct threat to the UK has been growing. Sunak's reportedly going to announce some new warships that enable amphibious warfare in a few weeks' time. Mm. And the Sun splash today says Russia is targeting BA and Ryanair planes by creating fake objects that they are forced to dive or swerve away from, which is pretty scary. And Penny Mordaunt popped up in the Sunday Telegraph to demand a new missile defence system. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so, this ties into the story we were just talking about, because lack of funding from the US, you know, is not just a game changer sort of practically, but psychologically, I think it would signal to Kremlin that the sort of unity of the West was breaking down, that our sense of purpose was beginning to fracture. The stories about defense spending in the UK really tie into that same sense of insecurity that you know, Russia will not stop where it's got to. If it's allowed to continue, there will be another target and another bit of election interference, you know, and another poisoning in another country, and that it's a bad faith actor. And defense spending emerging as an issue for the election, which I think it already is and will do so increasingly, is quite difficult, I think, for the Conservatives, because there are certain departmental budgets that are already sort of ring-fenced. The NHS budget, for one, let's say. Pensions is another one, if they're planning to renew their sort of triple lock promise. So if there's a bunch of departments which have been promised real terms increases and which cannot be touched really, the more you pile onto that side, the more budgets like local authorities or education have to be depleted, because the government has undertaken to reduce borrowing overall against a framework of flat economic growth. So that is a really simple equation. If you say X has to grow while Y stays the same and Z goes down, it means they're going to have to cut money from somewhere. And like I said, the more you add to the pile that says we must increase this, the more questions will be asked about what is going on to the pile that says we have to cut this.
The chief exec of the Climate Change Committee had a go at Sunak yesterday, saying he was setting us back on net zero. What did Claire Coutinho, the net zero secretary, have to say on her broadcast round yesterday?
Very little, to be honest. I mean, she claimed that the government is doing brilliantly, that it's exceeding all of its targets. She also wanted credit for the fact that, and I quote, we have cut emissions by half while growing the economy by 80%. That's quite a striking claim. So I went back and looked at GDP figures to try and work out since when she meant, right? What period she was looking at. And it turns out she's claiming credit for everything that has happened since 1990. So the major government, the Blair government, the Brown government, you know, she's claiming credit for the lot. if you have a look at their actual stint, this government since 2019, the opposite has happened. So the battle to cut carbon emissions has stalled. They have actually gone slightly up one year and then slightly down the next. And growth has certainly been flat. Even if you take out the pandemic, growth has been flat. So, you know, it's really quite a striking thing to say, to claim credit for everything that's happened since 1990 and suggest that this means we can take it easy now. She also accused Labour of planning to close the North Sea. That's a quote, which will be a blow to Dominic Raab, I imagine, who hates it when the sea is closed.
More on the PM. You can't say he hasn't been busy the last few days. He announced he was cracking down on sick leave in an effort to get more people back to work. There has been a lot of criticism of that, and I know you feel strongly about it, Alex.
Yes, I feel strongly about it because I've had experience of trying to access the health system. You know, both my partner has been trying to access some help for his mental health, and I've been trying to access some help for my physical health. You know, I've been in really severe pain for just over 2 years. And it just seems astonishing to me that having broken really so many elements of what is required to keep people healthy in this country, from local services to mental health services, the waiting lists in the NHS, the Prime Minister now turns around and blames the people who are suffering for the fact they are suffering. You know, and let's not forget long COVID, something that affects over a million people in this country. This was the Chancellor that instigated Eat Out to Help Out without taking any advice from his medical advisors because he thought they might put the kibosh on his plan. And now he's turning around and saying, you know, you're all faking it. I find it astonishingly cack-handed. I cannot see that it will motivate any voters currently thinking that this government has had it to change their mind. And it comes actually hot on the heel of a major scheme that helps disabled people back into work being quietly scrapped. This is the Work and Health Programme that operates in England and Wales that you know, will take 100 million out of that exact budget to get people with disabilities back into work and help employers make the adjustments, help them have the training, etc. He just seems to be fishing in an ever smaller pond of really angry voters. And I think it's turning the rest of the country, the rest of the voting public, even angrier at him.
Meanwhile, Michael Gove is going to disappoint a lot of leaseholders this week. Tell us why.
Well, because there have been wide reports that the leasehold reform bill was going to be watered down, and it seems to be confirmed actually in the Sunday Times, who have details of the changes that have been made to his sort of leasehold shakeup, which means that basically millions of leaseholders will continue to pay ground rent for up to 20 years, although he's expected to announce some sort of capping of increase on the charges. But, you know, this was a bill that was meant to bring in wholesale reform to a system that is really bizarre and arcane, and there's very little rational reason for it. And he seems to have come up directly against people on the bank benches who are basically landlords who benefit from this system. And, you know, we've ended up in a situation where really he might as well not have bothered.
The Met came in for a lot of criticism over the weekend, which is, of course, nothing new for the Met. An officer at a pro-Palestinian demo told the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism chief that he was visibly Jewish and he threatened to arrest him for breach of the peace. Is this existential for the Met chief, Sir Mark Rowley?
It might be. I'm not sure it should be. I have to say I had one view on this, and then I watched the full clip, which is now on the Sky News website, the full 13-minute clip, and it has slightly changed my mind because this conversation did go on for a very long time. The police officer in question did offer to provide safe passage for that person through a slightly different route. And it seems to me that, you know, the man was there to make a point, which I get. I completely get it, right? But it did put the people trying to police the event in a no-win situation. Because if they don't allow him to sort of cross this rally, then they risk being accused of not tackling anti-Semitism. If they do allow him, then they risk some kind of reaction from the crowd and some kind of civil disorder. And so I just think the police face enough no-win scenarios that they try to balance as best they can for us to create even more for them just to make a point. And so, I mean, obviously what that police officer said is utterly, utterly unacceptable. But it was a 13-minute conversation where he was trying to explain something and the other person kept insisting to put themselves in a situation of possible harm. And so, you know, plainly the police should be trying to address the possibility of harm that is there rather than the people who do nothing wrong and face that harm. That is clear enough. The operational situation you have there at the moment means it is easier to protect the one person rather than to change the underlying situation for the whole country. And so it's a really hard one.
Yeah, it is a really hard one. What's the latest on the war in the Middle East? Is Israel going to go ahead with its operation in Rafah, despite the US begging it not to?
I think there are some interesting developments going on. So the White House has asked Netanyahu not to attack Rafah, not to go on with this sort of boots on the ground clearing of it. Netanyahu has said, forget it, I will do what I want. But there's been a couple of developments that are sort of slightly off left field. So there are noises coming that maybe the White House will not continue to, for instance, veto the recognition of Palestine as an independent country in the UN, which it's currently doing. And it's only the US's veto that's sort of keeping that from happening. And there's also reports in relatively reliable news outlets that the White House is planning to take sanctions against a specific unit of the IDF, which operates in the Gaza Strip, because there have been reports about it basically causing too many civilian casualties. Maybe the White House cannot stop Netanyahu doing what he wants to do, but it seems to me that they're beginning to threaten that if Netanyahu basically ignores them, then maybe the strength of their traditional alliance and their complete support for each other is up for grabs on other issues.
And Donald Trump's trial in New York continues, though he keeps nodding off and reportedly farting during his naps. What's due to happen this week, Alex?
It's just like the most Trump thing ever, isn't it?
Trumping, yeah, exactly.
I mean, actually, so today's the first day of the actual trial, I have to say, with my former legal hat on. What came before was pre-trial motions, which include jury selection. So I think some of it will be very technical because it involves sort of accounting and payments and where they come out of and how they're justified and then how they're paid back. So some of it is very tedious, but a lot of it is incredibly salacious. So the prosecution planned to to call not only Stormy Daniel, the porn star that he's alleged to have paid hush money to out of campaign funds, which is the thing that's not allowed, but also other women that Trump had an affair with and tried to hush, as former Playboy bunnies and people like that. So I think a lot of people will be watching it because it's that weird mix of legal and soap opera. Trump has been very good at turning all of this to his political advantage, but it seems to me that during the last week, he has looked increasingly exhausted and frustrated by it. He's complained that the courtroom is cold. He has to sit there and watch things being said about him and not being able to say anything. He has to shut up. He cannot do anything else or go anywhere else. He cannot do rallies or fundraise. You know, he's stuck there. And it seems to me it's the first situation in a very long time where he's not in control. And it seems to be really getting to him.
Will be worth watching. Thanks so much, Alex.
My pleasure.
And you can support us to keep making Bunkers for just £3 a month. As the ad market gets tougher, we're even more grateful for your support. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast or follow the link in the show notes. Backers get shows ad-free and early, plus a shout-out on this show. Here's Alex with today's.
Big Monday hugs to Andy Neal, John Beard and Brian Pay.
I'm Ros Taylor and thanks for listening. Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Start Your Week from the Bunker was written and presented by Ros Taylor with Alex Andreu. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.